Hello, welcome back. This is Rob Cohen, and as I mentioned last time, Phil Cohen, my brother, is back, and we're going to be discussing The Trident Deception by Rick Campbell. And it seems like we've been having a good time with this, so maybe we'll start adding it as an every other recording type of a deal, where we'll pick a book, and maybe we'll alternate. Each of us will pick a book and then read it and talk about it. I think it... I know for me, it gives me an opportunity to read a lot of different kinds of books that I wouldn't normally read or books that I wouldn't know anything about. Certainly Galveston was like that. I had no expectation about it, didn't know anything about it, and frankly, when you recommended it, I just bought it. I didn't even read what the synopsis was. So I think that's kind of a good opportunity for me to get a little bit out of my comfort zone. And then also for you, who knows, maybe you'll find something that you like. So anyways, what I want to do right now, I'm going to pause this because I took some notes and I'm gonna go get them. All right, so I took notes. What I didn't take notes about was like plot and ideas about the book itself while I was reading it. I probably should have, because by now it's been, what, 3 weeks since we read it. I don't really remember too much. But I took notes about kind of what I call the techno thriller, because we talked about reading this book and then opening up the discussion about the techno thriller as a whole. So do you want to talk a little bit about what you see as the techno thriller, kind of your history of the techno thriller?
Well, sure.
My experience with the techno thriller, the military thriller, was much more relevant when I was younger. I remember, I think probably the first of that genre that I read was probably Flight of the Intruder by Stephen Kuntz when I was probably about 14 or 15. I read a couple of the Jake Grafton books in that series, obviously, and then, you know, did a little bit of the Dale Brown books, just the three of the Tom Clancy novels, and I really enjoyed them. And later I started to get into some other authors that their books just weren't as good, and I think it kind of turned me off to the genre. I got to the point where I was like, okay, every book nowadays is trying to be the next Hunt for October or the next Flight of the Old Dog, and you know, something where it's turning into everything was the bad guys were the Russians and the good guys were the Americans, and you're trying to stop World War III from occurring and keep the Cold War alive, and you know, kind of explains to you the time frame that I was reading these books. So I gave up on them for a really long time and started branching out into other genres. So to read the Trident Deception, it was a welcome return to that genre of novels. One of the authors that I've read, you know, pretty much religiously over the past 25 years is David Hagberg, and he's one that's been able to adapt in his writing styles, where he's realized that the times are changing and the enemies of America are changing, and his novels continue to change that way. But that being said, when an author like a David Hagberg comes out with another book, you kind of get the sense that he's telling the same story again and again and again, and you, just with different enemies. So it was interesting to get a chance to read The Trident Deception, because it was, a welcome return to that genre of novels. You know, it's interesting, as you're talking about that, it reminds me of other genres where the same type of a thing happens. And I think it's just a feature of society's craving for the next big thing, everybody jumping on the bandwagon, and then society either giving up on it and getting bored with it, or the quality of the bandwagon kind of falling off. And we had that with the techno thriller. We had that with the legal thrillers when John Grisham was big. Then everybody wanted to write a legal thriller, and after a while, it seemed like everybody was writing legal thrillers. They weren't that good, and then the demand went down. And you have a couple of people who are still in the game, so to speak, but even still, their popularity wanes. They don't come out with books as often, or they've tried to branch off into different genres separate from the legal thriller. I mean, John Grisham has had numerous books, some of which have nothing to do with the, you know, practice of law at all. We saw this, what I'd say was probably, what, 5 or 6 years ago with the Da Vinci Code. After that came out, everybody wanted to write mystery thrillers about the Templars and all that kind of stuff. And in fact, to just get to that issue, I just started today The Templar Legacy by Steve Barry, which was from 2004 or 2005, whatever it was. And it was right in that time frame where everybody was starting to write these books about the Templars. And so I think that's the way that the legal world goes, where you start to see the trends, and it kind of goes in a rolling wave where everything is really popular in one area and then it drops off. And as I was reading the book, The Trident Deception, I actually went onto Goodreads and I tried to find what, you know, the authors that were this quote-unquote techno-thriller genre. And in fact, Goodreads does not have a very good mechanism, because as I'm looking at the list, you know, they're reader-created lists. They're not official lists of any kind. But you look at these reader-created lists, and I just said, show me what the techno-thrillers are. And I'm getting names like Michael Crichton and Douglas Preston, Lincoln Child, and those to me are not what I would call the techno-thriller. So I wrote down the names of the people that either you or I read over the course of whatever, 25 years. So I've got Tom Clancy, Patrick Robinson, Michael DiMercurio, Bart Davis, Larry Bond, Richard P. Hendricks, Stephen Koons, W.B. Griffin, Dale Brown, Richard Herman, James Cobb, Joe Buff. And when you look at those names, you can tell there are a couple of names that stand out as being successful. You got your Tom Clancy, you got your Dale Brown, you got your Stephen Koons. And then you've got a whole bunch of other names that maybe they wrote two or three books and then you never heard from again. And I think that's the example of the downcrest of the wave of interest, where you've got so many people who started writing these books that after a while the society and the market was so inundated with them that people stopped reading them.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, because not only were they seeing them in the bookstores, but now all of a sudden you're seeing all of these in movie theaters. So you're seeing The Hunt for October, you're seeing Patriot Games, you're seeing Flight of the Intruder, you're seeing Crimson Tide, you're seeing K-19, you're seeing all these movies that and keep in mind that right around, let me think, the early 90s, okay, so think about the time frame in the early 90s. The Cold War was basically still going on, although the Berlin Wall had come down in 1989. Hunt for October, obviously the book had come out in 1986 or 87. And that was, you know, that was the book that really started this explosion of the military thriller. You call it techno thriller, but I can think of a military thriller. And then early 90s, what happens? The United States is at war. And all of a sudden, people are starting to see Gulf War on TV and in their newspapers and their magazines. And they're like, well, I don't want to read this. It's going on. And the thing that is so interesting about the military thriller is the plausibility of all of these novels that had come out. And you're thinking to yourself, Jesus, if somebody, and we talked about this on one of your past podcasts, like, Jesus, if if one of these authors is coming up with this, surely our enemies can come up with something like that. Excuse me. We were talked about, who was it that wrote the book? Tom Clancy wrote the book about the guy crashing the plane into the White House. I mean, David Hagberg was writing about Osama bin Laden in the mid-90s. So I think it was the plausibility of it. And all of a sudden, these military thrillers were not escapism. They were reality. And, you know, contrary to what, you know, you and I would think of as a horror novel, these were horror novels. I mean, they were frightening. So you get into the early 90s, you've got the Gulf War. Gulf War ends. Things kind of tend to lull down. That's when you get the John Grishams. People's tastes have changed. And now you get back into the early 2000s. Boom. The United States is at war again, and they're not reading these people anymore. And the authors that have lasted this long, the Stephen Koons, the Tom Clancy's, the Dale Browns, it's because they have their legions of readers. You're not finding readers out there going to find new authors in this genre because it's too real. I mean, the time frames are too real, and the current day is too real, so the books are too real.
Yeah, and that's interesting. And I think that there were the techno thriller, the military fiction, whatever you want to call it, one of the major criticisms about it was that they were too technical, that it really required a smaller subset of the community who had the capability of reading these things, otherwise it was going to go over the reader's head. And I know that was a criticism of Tom Clancy, and in fact, we started reading Tom Clancy, I think I was 12 or 13 years old, we read Hunt for October, and a lot of that was over my head, but you had
you know, Patriot Games was after that, which was really straightforward. There was no complexity to that. It wasn't a, I wouldn't call that a techno thriller so much as I just call it a thriller because it didn't have submarines and warships and things like that. But then you get to like Cardinal of the Kremlin, and I read it. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I read it. I liked it. I remember small parts of it, but it was really technical. It was the Star Wars. It was the space program. It was Glasnost and Perestroika, whatever it is. And I think that a lot of society started getting either confused or they got bored with being bogged down with, you know, with these highly technical descriptions. Mm-hmm. And you look at the list that I talked about earlier, the other authors, so many of them wrote just plain straightforward books, didn't have a lot of complexity. And in fact, there were just deviations of the same story, like mm-hmm. what you had said. It's just the same story told in a different way. And in fact, as I'm reading The Trident Deception, I'm thinking the same thing. I am thinking it's the same story. and I was hoping that... I was hoping that this being, you know, 25 years later, that it would be different. And frankly, it wasn't a book that I was looking for. It wasn't like I said, wow, I really want to read this type of a book right now, because frankly, I haven't read any of those books other than the Tom Clancy books, which I've kept up with. I haven't read any of those books since I was, you know, 19 or 20 years old. Mm-hmm. So to pick this one up now, which was just by happenstance, and I'm walking in Barnes & Noble and I see it, and I see, you know, the submarine on the cover, and there's an air, you know, some sort of a jet on top of it. It caught my eye, and it was like, okay, well, you know, maybe I can revisit a little bit of my childhood and we'll give it a shot. It's purely at that point escapism adventure, mm-hmm. because I don't consider this real life anymore, because that's not what we're being told from, you know, from our news media. Our news media is telling us about, you know, geopolitical intrigue and WikiLeaks and that kind of stuff. We don't really consider that there's still active military exercises that are happening in the oceans around the world. So this to me was a return to a bit of an escapism. You don't have a comment on that?
No,
okay.
I agree with you. I mean, you
email me, you pick this book. The only thing that I was able to read, because I looked on my phone, was the best military thriller since Hunt for Red October. And I said, okay, that's fine. That's great. I'm in. Yeah, so we read it.
I gave it
3 stars on Goodreads, and as I was driving over here, I feel like I really want to drop it down to maybe 2.
Okay. Why don't you tell a little bit about the story
was so far-fetched and so contrived, and everything had to be so conveniently placed in order for everything to happen. It was so frustrating, and the idea was that Israel is the bad guy, and of course I do not like when Israel is the bad guy. Israel intelligence finds out that Iran is going to have nuclear capabilities in about 10 days, and the Israeli defense minister wants to full-on attack them before Iran has the capabilities, and the prime minister says no. And then, by sheer happenstance, the prime minister's twin daughters are killed in a suicide bombing. And the prime minister says, all right, let's do it. But we can't make it look like we did it. We need to have a patsy. We need to have somebody else do it. So who else to ask to do it but America? So the Israelis trick America into thinking that they need to attack Iran by... They send a fake message to one submarine that has gone out on maneuvers off the coast, leaving from Pearl Harbor, send them a fake message that Washington, D.C. has been bombed and hit by nuclear weapons and everybody's dead and they need to launch their missiles at Iran. Right, it wasn't so much that they tricked the United States. They tricked the submarine. So they somehow got a member of somebody who works at the Pentagon or whatever it is. They turned him and they got him to go into the Pentagon, go into the war room or whatever it was, send the message to the submarine and then destroy everything else, so that there was no way. The key was not only that they sent the message to this one submarine that their orders were to launch all of their nuclear weapons against Iran because Washington, D.C. had been obliterated, but they also managed to cut off all communications with the submarine. And so that's where the real drama was. It's one thing you can call the submarine back and say, hey, it was a mess up, you know, we've taken care of it. But in this situation, there was radio silence. And in fact, the radio silence was also caused by one of the people on the submarine who jerry-rigged the radio controls to make it look like it wasn't working anymore, when in fact what he'd actually done was sabotage it so that there was no way to get communications to the submarine. I agree. Far-fetched. Felt so much like Crimson Tide, the movie. So, I mean, it was exactly Crimson Tide.
So, yes, it was a cross between Hunt for October and Crimson Tide. And here's the thing that doesn't make sense. I mentioned in the very beginning that Israel found out that Iran was going to have nuclear capabilities in 10 days. That's the time frame, 10 days. But Israel already had somebody in the Pentagon ready to send out the message and destroy all the communication systems. They already had somebody on this particular submarine blocking all the incomings and sabotaging it to make it look like everything was totally fine and they just weren't receiving any messages. And then finally, all of the other submarines in the fleet had been outfitted with this new technology that they couldn't find this one submarine, except for one really old submarine.
Was it the one from Australia?
Well, that was the second one that they sent. Okay. So everything, the time frame is 10 days, but everything had to happen. And you start to wonder, gee, Israel, like I said in the beginning, the bad guys, had all of this planned just in case, and now they were going to use it. Not to mention the fact that you find out much, much later that the defense minister had sent the suicide bomber in to kill the prime minister's twin daughters. It's so frustrating and so angry, and you know, it's Hunt for October because you've got one rogue ship that's basically going off to do something that it thinks it needs to do, and its whole rest of its country and the whole rest of the world trying to track it down. Okay, very similar to the Hunt for October. And then you mentioned Crimson Tide. You've got this ship that is basically in radio silence. It can't communicate with anybody. It's got its orders, and their weapons. Their weapons officer won't launch, and it's like they're reading. I don't understand. It makes you wonder what's going on with the military, the submarine. The weapons officer was given an order: launch your missiles, and he wouldn't. He had a conscience, but the conscience didn't come from anywhere because he had been told, Washington has been obliterated. They hit us with everything we've got. And still, they weren't like, hit them where it hurts. Like, this, why? Now he builds a conscience. And so now, he gets to the point where the assistant Weps launches. And now, somebody's got to shoot them out of space to make sure that they don't hit their targets, which they, you know, luckily they do. And in the same time, you've got a woman, Christine something or whatever, who is in the NSA, and she piece by piece is uncovering all this and trying to stop it, you know, bit by bit. Just completely implausible, completely frustrating. When I saw that the author was military, he served on submarines, I really expected something more. He was trying to build too much drama. It was so derivative of those two stories that we just mentioned. Here's a really good point. You've got The Hunt for October, you've got Crimson Tide. Two fantastic stories, two really well executed dramas, thrillers. What do they both have in common? One main protagonist. It takes place there. Crimson Tide, the movie, it takes place on the ship. Hunt for October, it takes place with Jack Ryan. You only see a little bit of the sides with Marco Ramius and with the Red October, but it's basically that. This book, you had the assistant Weps officer on the submarine. You had his dad, who's trying to, who's a military globe trying to try and catch him. You've got Christine, the NSA, who's trying to solve it. And you've got the Israeli defense minister, not to mention the jackal, whoever, I'm calling him the jackal, but it's the mysterious Mossad who's killing everybody on the way to make sure that this all goes through. It was, the guy tried to do too much, and, I was glad to be done with it at the end.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, that he tried to make it too much, and I agree with you, the story stopped and started too many times, where you'd get 100 pages would fly by in a second, it seemed, and then 100 pages would drag on and nothing seemed to happen, and it took place over the course of 10 days, and you had some things where nothing happened on a certain day, so it was over in 2 chapters, and then some things where it seemed like it was 50 chapters or 10 chapters before the day was over, and I agree. It just felt like there was too much going on. Aside from the implausibility of it, it just tried to do too much.
Yeah.
And it could have. I'm not going to say that it was an impossible feat. I think you could have done it where you brought in all these main characters, but you would have needed to make it longer. Would have had to make it over more than a 10-day story. You would have had to start it earlier. You would have had to give the Israeli defense minister a motive and establish that earlier. You would have had to develop the characters better so that you understood why they were where they were when all of these things happened. And he didn't do it. And I think the reason why is because he wanted to create the tension. You have 10 days. You have a ticking clock. A ticking clock is a great creator of anxiety and tension because you know at some point the clock is going to get to zero.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think that he didn't need to do that to himself. He created his own restrictions by doing that.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he also created characters which were, I'm not going to say superhuman, but they appeared to be acting outside of rational thought, what you would expect people to, how you would expect people to act. I mean, at the end of the book, this woman, Christine, who's the national security advisor, goes to the Israeli defense minister's house and kills him. It's like, really?
Yeah.
She's the national security advisor. She's not traveling halfway across the world to kill somebody.
Yeah.
And even though she had been the subject of an attack and somebody tried to assassinate her and all that, I mean, still, you have your SEAL team go in, or you got your special forces or Delta, whatever it is, you're not having your national security advisor go over there to kill this guy.
She needed to see it done because the turncoat in this whole thing was her ex-husband, who tried to kill her in her kitchen. And again, it was all... Are you thinking of lowering your 3 stars?
No. Is that what I gave it, 3 stars? I don't remember. Aside from the implausibilities of that, the other additional implausibilities were this ship, and it was the Kentucky, getting from Hawaii to some location in the east, in the far east, someplace where they were within launching distance. This ship must have been the slowest freaking ship in the world because all these other ships managed to catch up to it. And then, for whatever reason, they either blew off or they got exploded, whatever happened.
They lost them.
Okay. So you had this ship that was just chugging along, and then the U.S. figured out a way to contact the other ships and say, go find a ship and sink it. And those other ships were able to, I guess, fly faster. They moved through the water faster, caught up to the ship, lost the ship, fell away for whatever reason. Then this guy has the time, the junior weapons officer's father, Wilson, he has the time to fly to Australia, get on another ship, then take that ship into Southeast Asia, wherever it is. It was just implausible. But did you read all the way to the end? Because the author explains it. All right, here.
Oh, I
did you read it?
I had to make things up because I didn't want to be too real and explain, like, real secrets of the military or something. Is that what he said? Because I did read it, but I blew that guy off by the time I got to the end.
He did say he wanted to make it as realistic as possible, but he did not want to put any classified information, reveal any classified information.
That's that guy striking his own ego.
And he says, in particular, no classified information could be revealed, which required me to alter some capabilities of ships and weapons employed in the novel. Speed and range, for example, which I'm sure some of you have detected, have no doubt explained, that's not right. You are correct. If they were accurate, this novel would be classified, so I had to tweak a few things.
What a jerk.
What a jerk. He's saying, I created all these super fast ships, and I created this one real super slow ship. You know what? All that being said, I'd probably read another one. I didn't dislike the characters. I thought they were fine. They were all pretty standard stock characters. There wasn't anything spectacular about them.
Yeah.
As in a lot of the authors that I mentioned earlier, I did read at least a couple of their books before I realized that they were not going anywhere. I'm curious where the 21st century military techno thriller is going to go, because I've been keeping up with the Tom Clancy books, even though he's now dead. Within the past few years, I think he did write 4 or 5 new books in the Jack Ryan series. And so that...
Still have yet to come out?
No. I think he was real prolific in his writing up through what was called Teeth of the Tiger, and that was Jack Ryan's son.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was kind of off the radar for a long, long time. I think it was probably 9 or 10 years. And then he came back with new series of books, not a new series, but with books in the same series which continued the stories of all the characters. So you've got Jack Ryan, you've got Jack Ryan Jr., you've got John Clark, you've got Chavez, and then you've got additional kind of new characters. So it's all within the same canon of the Jack Ryan story arc. And he's managed to keep the global or the geopolitical climate pretty current. I mean, I would say a lot of Jack Ryan's success was in dealing with, or he's known as, the Cold War hero. I mean, you've got Hunt for October and Red Storm Rising, although that wasn't Jack Ryan. You've got Cardinal of the Kremlin. Those were true Cold War novels. But then you got to Clear and Present Danger, which is a drug cartel. You got Dead of Honor, which was kind of the Japanese and the challenge to the economy. You've got The Sum of All Fears, which was the Middle East. You've got Executive Orders, which was the Middle East. You got The Bear and the Dragon, which was Russia and China. So Clancy did what I think of a really good job of keeping up with the times, like you had mentioned David Hagberg does, and keeping them, for the most part, fresh, although at the end of the day, the story is the same. Right. It's the big bad country run by some sort of a dictator who's trying to overthrow the world or whatever it is. And these most recent spate of books, it's very similar. We went back to the Middle East. We went into Japan or China or whatever it was. But it's updated. It's now, it's now information and technology. It's the internet. It's still, nuclear weapons, whatever it is. So I'm interested in seeing how Tom Clancy continues with that, given that he's dead, but he's got authors that he worked with. And that's why I'd be interested in reading another book by Rick Campbell, because I want to see, is he going to fall into the same trap that these other authors we talked about did, which is, I wrote 3 books, they all were the same story told 3 different times, but with a different bad guy, and then I ran out of ideas. And you don't have a comment on that?
No,
I mean, that was...
My comment is I'm not interested in reading any more of his books.
Okay, and that's fair. All I knew about the book, other than the cover, was the Hunt for Best Since Hunt for October.
And I was sold by it.
And it could be the best since Hunt for October, because there ain't been a whole lot.
Huh.
In 20 years, since call it the mid-90s, there may not have been as many of these books.
You're probably
right. I mean, I remember reading one of these books, whatever it was, and thought, wow, a woman in charge of a battleship? Who would have thought that? I mean, that was, you never saw that before, and it was kind of implausible. Okay. I mean, I would read another one.
Okay.
I don't know that I'd want to buy it in hardcover.
Well, let me know how it is. But
I'm curious. Some of the characters I liked enough to want to see what happened to them again.
Okay.
I mean, if you actually think those can be the same characters. And maybe not. Who knows?
I mean, there's so many of them. I assume it would be the NSA, that woman... Christine, what's her name? You know, you're always in trouble when there's a list of characters
at the end of the book to help you, which I had to refer to many a time to go, who is this again? Anyways.
Yeah, but for a 375 or 380 page book to have to keep referring to characters, it meant that they weren't resonating.
Yeah, it wasn't worthwhile.
But yeah, he's got a sequel, Empire Rising. That's, I guess, the next one that's coming out.
Sounds Japanese to me.
Okay, hey.
So, hey, no, again, it was a good experience, and I'm glad we did it, and, you know, it sounds like we agree on the book itself, so, you know, so far we've been pretty good on that. I did want to mention one thing, to go back to one of your previous podcasts, actually, because I do listen. I made a note of it. You were talking about a murder in Auschwitz.
Oh, yeah.
And you asked the question about why would, I don't remember the protagonist's name, why would Manfred defend this Nazi guard? Why would he do it? And you said, you know, in your podcast, you know, it the author probably did that to make the reader think, what would I do in that situation? And I think you missed the point. The point was that you wanted to know why Manfred defended him. Manfred had been a very successful lawyer before the war. And when he was taken to Auschwitz, he was stripped of everything. His entire being, his entire life, his entire persona, his entire humanity was taken. This opportunity gave him, this situation gave him an opportunity to be human again. That's why he did it. He felt like he could do something. He had been a victim for as long as he'd been in the camp, as long as he had been a Jew in Nazi Germany, even from before he was taken. He had been a nothing. And now he had an opportunity to be a something. And it gave him his humanity back. And it gave him an opportunity to say, I am somebody. And I can do something. And this is what I was. And this is what I am. And no barbed wire. No gas chambers. No nothing is going to take that away from me. Until I let them take it from me. And that's why he did it.
And you're absolutely right. And sometimes a failing of mine is I don't prepare when I record, and I just talk off the top of my head. And after I listened to it, because I listened to him as well, I thought the same thing. I mean, it occurred to me as I'm listening to it, which is being in the concentration camp is such a dehumanizing endeavor and experience, that this was his chance to be human again, to feel like he had worth. And you're absolutely right. That absolutely was the reason. And yes, we all can say, if we were in that position, what would we do? But I think from this character, who, as you're reading the story, you get the feeling that he really loved what he did. This was an opportunity for him to reconnect with what he believed made him who he was. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but he did have a goal. And I don't know if I mentioned it in the podcast, but there was a reward for him for doing what he did. And it was, he actually, spoiler alert, when he was asked by the Nazi officer who was on trial, when he was asked by him to represent him, Manfred said, before I take the job, I want to speak with the commandant of the camp. And so Manfred goes and speaks with the commandant of the camp, and he says, if I do this, and if I succeed, and I prevail, then I want you to reunite me with my wife. Because she was in a different... They were at the camp together, and then they were separated. The wife and the two daughters were separated. And so that was what his reward was. He said, look, I'm going to die one way or the other. If I fail and this guy gets convicted, you're going to kill me. If I succeed and this guy gets away with it, you're going to kill me. But my one way of getting benefit out of this is I want to be reunited with my wife. And so obviously he succeeds. He gets reunited with his wife. Now,
during the reading of the, or during the book, he learns at some point that his daughters, his twin daughters, are dead. And so that's a particularly emotional scene. And now he feels like the only thing he has to live for is to see his wife again. And so as he prevails, he gets, for whatever it was, and they don't, for the characterization that we've experienced of Nazis, they could have said, you know, go to hell, great, you won, you know, here's a bullet in the back of the head, we're not keeping our word. Right. But they did, they kept their word, and they reunited him with his wife, and then of course they both end up dying. They go through the camp, and I think they get reunited, and they quickly right after that go into the gas chamber and they're gone. I mean, it wasn't like they separated again. I think that was it. But the catharsis of it was that he got to reunite with his wife. But the other aspect of it was you find out that the daughters did not die. And you find out there's a postscript.
He does not find out.
There's a postscript or an epilogue, or I'm not sure how it's characterized in the last chapter of the book, but there's these two adult women who, I believe this is what happened, they revisit the camp kind of as tourists. And it turns out that they were taken away by Joseph Mengele because they were twins, and for whatever it was, there was something that happened. And they were not killed. There were some tests that were performed against them, but they survived. And so you got a little bit of the catharsis from that. Again, this is one of those books where I really wanted it to be longer.
Right.
Because I wanted to develop that emotional connection with all the characters, and I didn't think that I had an opportunity to do that. But you're absolutely right. As I listened to it again, the response was, he felt human again. And I think part of the, I'm not going to say failing, but part of the part of where the book kind of lacked was it didn't make that abundantly clear. And maybe it was just for the reader to interpret, but it didn't come off as 100% clear that that's what that was.
I don't remember. How was the book told? Was it first person or third person?
Third person.
Then you won't get that. It has to be a first person book for you to get that feeling out of the character. I mean, think about it. Him to say, you know, boy, I could do this, and you know, I used to be really good at this. Like, yeah, I can do it. Compared to, and Manfred sat in his bunk and he thought, and he said, you know what? Why not? So you mean it, that's where it is, and you're left to. I mean, you're talking about a book that is intended to be thought provoking. I don't think the writer's job is to make that abundantly clear. I think it is up to the reader to say, I totally understand why he did it. It made him feel like something when he had been made to feel like a nothing for so long.
You know, it's interesting. You read a book like, or I read a book like that one, like A Murder in Auschwitz, and it reminds me of something that I heard just last week. So we went to the LA Times Festival of Books, and we saw Todd Goldberg, our fraternity brother. And it just so happened, I don't know if I told you this, it just so happened that he was signing books at a tent right next to an author. What's that?
You told us in the last podcast.
No.
Yeah, you did.
No, because this was last time I ever recorded since then. He was sitting right next to the author of a book that I was reading. Right, I was in the middle of the book. I was 100 pages into the book. And I'll get to the story of that book in a second, but I excused myself from Todd for a second so I could get this new book by this guy signed and told him that I enjoyed the book, et cetera, et cetera. And then when I got back to Todd, he said, so you read this guy's books? And I said, yeah. He says, wow, it's a great premise for a series of books. And I said, yeah. He says, it's one of those things where you sit there and go, why couldn't I have come up with that? And that was how I felt about A Murder in Auschwitz. It was like, why couldn't I come up with that story? And if I did come up with that story, here's how I could have done it differently, and who knows what kind of a impact it would have had or how it would have been different. So yeah, it's every once in a while I'll read a book where I go, wow, that is such a great idea. I wish I'd come up with it, because who knows, maybe I could have had a different idea, or I could have a different spin on it, or could have delivered it in a different way that maybe would have been more to my suited feeling. And I don't remember who it was, but there was somebody, I read a quote, an author, I don't remember who it was, but the quote was something along the lines of, I wrote books
because nobody wrote the books I wanted to read. And it was like, I wrote the books that I would want to read because nobody was writing those books.
Right.
And it's kind of like, yeah, that's exactly. I've got an idea in my head of what kind of a book I want to read, and I'm having a hard time finding it. I might as well freaking write it myself. Well, but I'm not going to, or I don't think I have the discipline or the patience to do it, but that's kind of how I sometimes feel after I read these books. So anyways, it was interesting. That was another, yeah, that was my thought after reading A Murder in Auschwitz.
Right.
And, you know, after listening to every one of your podcasts, I already know how your book is going to start. It's going to start, "It was a foggy night on the cobblestone streets of London." So get this. So I bought for Amy this gift for Hanukkah. And in order to get it,
safe to mention?
Yeah, in order to get it, I had to get it off the Amazon UK website. So it was a manufacturer in London. I don't know if I showed you. It's these wall decals, and they're in the shape of the London Underground sign. Except I had them specially made, so instead of the name of the stop, the tube stop, I have one that says Brooklyn and one that says Kensington for. Obviously, for two girls.
Probably existed.
Well, you got South Kensington, but not by itself. So now that I've ordered this one thing, now I get emails pretty much weekly from the Amazon UK website of things you might like. And given that I've have this kind of Jack the Ripper, Victorian England interest, I've started to get emails from amazon.co.uk, which are these Jack the Ripper types of things. So I ordered this book. It's I can't wait to get it. It's like a picture book of London in the time of Jack the Ripper and now. So it takes a picture, two pictures.
Yeah.
It takes a picture from that
like
time and then shows where it is now. Yeah. And I'm thinking, wow, this is the reference book where you start from. Yeah. So I'm supposed to get it in I don't know, another week or so. But I had to pay in pounds, so it's like twice as much. But anyways, that one I'm kind of looking forward to. But yeah, that's the idea of the book that I would, you know, for at least for my own interest right now, seems interesting. So anyways, so what have you been reading since then? Trying to Deception was a few weeks, so you've read like 9 books since then, right?
Yeah, not even close, actually. I think I just
read one book since then. I can't remember. I guess I should. The last one that I finished.
Read the Westwood.
Right. I read Seth MacFarlane's book. I forgot. So good. I mean, it's funny. It's stupid. It's A Million Ways to Die in the West. It's Seth MacFarlane of Family Guy fame wrote and directed A Million Ways to Die in the West. It comes out, I think, in about a month. But while they were shooting in New Mexico, I think, at least I want to say, on the weekends, he was writing the movie tie-in, because I heard him on an interview once talk about how he used to, when he was a kid, similar to you and I, he used to love to read the movie tie-in books of the movies before they came out, so he would know. And Rob's laughing because that's what we used to do. Every other week, we would read a different movie tie-in, whether it was Back to the Future or RoboCop or A Night in the Life of Jimmy Reardon, or I mean any of them, we read them.
Grease at a swap meet.
Yeah, we read them, and we would go Die Hard. I read Die Hard. Of course, it was a novel first, but nevertheless, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. I mean, we read them, and it was awesome to see in the middle. They had pictures, still pictures from the Goonies. I remember reading the Goonies. So I read Seth MacFarlane's book.
Explorers.
Yeah. I really liked it. It was, you know, it was campy, and I could definitely see it being a good movie. The funny thing is that because the trailer is online and because it has an IMDb page, it's very easy to look and see who played these characters, and obviously Charlize Theron and Sarah Silverman and Giovanni Ribisi and Liam Neeson, and obviously this great, great cast. But to know that Seth MacFarlane was making the movie, and on the weekends, he was writing this book, and to still see scenes in the trailer that aren't in the book is really confusing to me. But I, because you would think, oh, well, they must have edited it out, but they would have edited it out of the movie. You know, it's kind of like when you read The Goonies, and there was this whole battle with an octopus.
Oh, right.
And it's totally not in the movie,
But at the very end, when the Goonies escape and they're rescued and they're being interviewed by news people, one of the kids, maybe it was Mouth, says, "Oh yeah, there was the octopus." It's like, well, only anybody that read the movie tie-in knew it, but they, you know, Richard Donner decided to cut it out of the final print. So it's kind of one of those things. But nevertheless, very simple read. I can't wait to see Sarah Silverman because her character is really, really terrific. It was just a lot of fun.
I remember going back to that. There was I read the movie tie-in for Rain Man, and I remember distinctly there was some sort of a scene in the book where the Dustin Hoffman character Raymond, who was autistic, I think, I'm not sure what his
he was an idiot.
I guess he and his brother Tom Cruise character were at somebody's house, and while the Tom Cruise character was talking to the person in the house, the Rain Man character was like shadow pitching, and he was going through this whole entire windup and throwing this entire baseball game. And I remember telling Mom, "Oh, when we see this movie, there's this great scene where this, that, and this happens." Of course, it wasn't in the movie; it was only in the book. But I don't read those anymore.
Yeah,
I know. I just don't, and I've seen them. I'm much more likely to go read a book that was a novel first than the movie tie-ins. To me, they don't do it anymore. But that's okay. That was how we cut our teeth reading. You know, I think it helps the imagination process to read a book like that, where you get the instant or nearly instant gratification of seeing on screen what you were able to picture in your head. And whether the imagination that you have directly correlates with what the director's vision of the movie was, it doesn't really matter so much as you get some validation that what you're reading is actually what's being portrayed on the screen. And I think there's benefit to that. And it's an easy read. You don't have to worry too much about creating characters in your mind or trying to, especially science fiction type stuff, create worlds that don't exist.
Right.
But other than that, I don't want to read the book, but I want to see the movie. Aside from the fact that I think it's out on hardcover and I refuse to pay hardcover prices for a movie tie-in.
I was just looking for something light to read, and you know, obviously I'm a fan of Seth MacFarlane, so I was curious about reading it. I was just looking through my Kindle. Apparently, I read some book called Non-Official Asset by William Sewell. I clearly didn't care enough about it to remember it. I actually, to tell you the truth, now that I look at it, I remember being really disappointed. So it was probably one of those book deals of the day, and it was like $2.99, and I don't know. Anyways, being disappointed. But
before you get to that one, because I want to spend some time on that one, because I know which one you're going to talk about. I'll tell you the books I've read, and then we'll get to the piece de resistance, the one that I really want to hear about.
Okay,
so after I read Trident Deception, I think I read three books.
All right.
And one of them that I mentioned in the last podcast, I was really, really excited about.
Yeah, I was curious. Called wanted to hear about this one.
The Revenant of Thraxton Hall, and it was the paranormal case books of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And first off, I actually
I only understand one word in that whole title, and it's of.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
I actually had to look up what, before I started the book, I had to look up what Revenant means.
And?
Ghost. So
I would have put that down.
No. You read the inside cover, and actually, I found this on Amazon, so it wasn't the inside cover, but it's all about seances and ghosts and things like that.
Yes.
So I've read quite a few books that incorporate the idea of seances.
Yeah,
it creeps me out.
What's wrong with you?
But I've actually read a few, and one of them. The first book I think I read about seances was actually nonfiction. It was about Harry Houdini. And it was, I think, Harry Houdini, the world's first superhero or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Which is when I first learned about this real cult of seance devotees and how Arthur Conan Doyle was really big into the seances and this psychic society where there's actually a society of people who got together and had these seances. And then I read this book, the Ghost Ship of the Mary Celeste, which was the seance. So I had a
Do you remember the Jamie Kennedy experiment where they did the Ghost Ship musical? Remember that movie Ghost Ship with Juliana Margulies? And they did the musical.
That's what I keep thinking about when you talk about that on your podcast. I was like, trapped.
on a ghost ship, and they're running, and they're running, and they stop, and they hear things. Oh, okay.
Man, I really wish that's what the book were like. That book was terrible. So this one, I was actually, it seemed like it brought together a lot of themes that I was interested in. Yes, the seances were a little bit potentially creepy, and I expected there would be a little bit of an icky or eerie factor to it. But the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle character, it adds the character of Oscar Wilde. And so basically what it is, it's Arthur Conan Doyle is now basically the world's most hated person in the world because he's just killed Sherlock Holmes. He's just written and released The Final Solution, where Sherlock Holmes falls to his death at Reichenbach Falls, and the entire country, if not the world, thinks he's the biggest villain, and they all, in fact, are wearing black armbands in grief. Over the death of Sherlock Holmes.
But he was still alive at the end of the movie.
Okay, so I just want to let you know, there was a long period of time where there were no Sherlock Holmes stories, and people thought he was really dead.
But that was that part from Game of Shadows, yes, where he goes over the side with the Moriarty.
Correct.
And then at the very end, Watson receives something on his desk, and then turns out that Holmes is in camouflage sitting in the chair.
Correct.
What a great ending.
Correct.
Is that how it was in the books?
No.
I like it.
Because there was a long period of time in which Sherlock Holmes was dead.
Right.
And in fact, Arthur Conan Doyle was tired of writing Sherlock Holmes and wanted to delve into different areas. In fact, he'd written books before Sherlock Holmes, which fell flat. Yeah. Then he wrote the Sherlock Holmes canon, and then he wanted to be rid of it and eventually came back to it.
Yeah.
Anyways, he's the world's most hated person, and he gets summoned to this mansion. He walks into this room, and it's all mysterious, and in fact the room is in pitch black darkness because the lady of the house has some sort of a disability or a whatever it is where she can't see light.
Of course she does.
And she says that she's a psychic, and she has seen that in some specific 2 weeks' time, she's going to be killed at a seance that she's conducting. And the only face that she recognizes during this vision is Arthur Conan Doyle. So she knows he's there, so she wants him to solve her murder that's going to take place in 2 weeks. Well, from there,
At what point did Arthur Conan Doyle say, "Hey, I tell you what, don't have the seance"?
Yeah, he thought she was crazy, and he kind of just blew it off. But curiosity getting the best of him, he decides he's going to go, and he takes Oscar Wilde with him. Oscar Wilde, I don't know much about him. I know he wrote Picture of Dorian Gray. I don't know a whole lot else about him, but this dude was so, according to the book, so flamboyant and so out there that he was like the comic relief. And I read one review after I'd finished this book that said the book was good. It was a good thing they brought Oscar Wilde into the story because Arthur Conan Doyle could not have carried the story all by himself. Huh. And I think that's true.
Okay.
But anyways, what you've got, what it ends up being, is it's a closed room mystery, like
Clue.
And Then There Were None, Agatha Christie, Clue. It's a closed room mystery that at the same time brings in this paranormal type of an atmosphere of this. The closed room is comprised of these people who come to this mansion because they're interested in the psychic arts, and they want to have these seances, and they have these few seances, and you know, strange things happen, and there are ghosts and stuff.
Didn't invite them?
No, it was not Murder by Death.
Lionel Twain.
Yeah, and he lived at 2222 Twain. So, anyways, that was that, and there was a spookiness factor. There was a little bit of ghosts that were. I like the stories where you've got these quote unquote ghosts that are explained at the end. You know, Scooby Doo takes the mask off and says, "We knew it was you all along." This didn't have it.
Like the Brady Bunch episode.
What Brady Bunch?
You remember the Brady Bunch episode where the Brady boys had to stay up in the attic for a whole night in order to take over, and they had like these spooky ghosts all over that they were. You don't remember this one? All right, never mind.
No, I don't. Okay.
And it had nothing to do with the mysterious idol that they found in Hawaii.
Oh, well, that I remember. Anyways, long story short, there was a spooky factor. There were some ghosts. There were some unexplained phenomena. But it was really, really enjoyable. It was more from a cartoonish, campy type feel. Less of a things go bump in the night kind of a feel.
Okay.
And there was this fantastic, fantastic reveal at the end that I don't want to give away, but when it happened, it went, oh my God! And it was like rewarding, like, oh, you totally got me, and it was worth it.
Good.
And it was enjoyable, and I really liked it. I like when you meld real people with fictional events.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked about that with the Lewis Bayard books. I talked about Matthew Pearl and all these other. I really enjoy that. In fact, I think the second chapter of the book, Arthur Conan Doyle and Oscar Wilde go to the theater, and James Barry is there. So the creator of Peter Pan. So I like that. And I'm looking forward to more of these books. I mean, it really was enjoyable. It wasn't too dark. It wasn't too scary. It was really enjoyable. I smiled a lot through the book because I really, and it was one of those things where like, wow, I really wish I could have written this book. That's how I felt. So I liked it. That was really a rewarding book. I read this. So the book I mentioned, having seen the author at the LA Times Festival of Books, this was called The Brothers of Baker Street. And it's the second in what is up till now a four-book series. The fourth book just came out in hardcover, which is what the author was signing at the Festival of Books. His name is Michael Robertson. And it is a great idea for a story. I don't know if I told you about it before. The idea is that these two British gentlemen, they're lawyers. Actually, one of them's a lawyer, and he has a brother. And he opens up his law practice.
What time frame?
Current day, present day. He opens up his law practice, and the location for his office is 221B Baker Street. And the only requirements of his lease are that a shit ton of fan mail goes to that location. People still write letters to Sherlock Holmes. And the terms of the lease state that they are to respond to every single letter and say, Sherlock Holmes, whatever it is, he doesn't live here anymore, you're nuts, whatever it is. He's high enough, exactly. And so the first book was called The Baker Street Letters, and of course, these guys, the two brothers who work there, they can't just follow the rules. They actually get a letter that they look at and say, wow, this could be a mystery, and they follow it to its end. And what I didn't like about the first book was, I would call myself, for lack of a better term, and I've only heard of this term recently, I'm kind of like an Anglophile, meaning I like all things British. I like London, and I was excited about reading that book because it took place in that area, and the vast majority of that story took place in Los Angeles.
Oh.
And it bugged me. I was like, well, okay, I could read a LA book on my own. So the second book, which just by happenstance it came out 3 or 4 years ago, just by whimsy, I ended up picking it up last week, and it turned out that I'm standing next talking to Todd, and this guy's right next to it. But the second book, it takes place actually in London, and it was called The Brothers of Baker Street, and I really liked it. I liked it a whole lot more because it took place in London. I had previously bought the third book in the series in paperback, and then the fourth book that just came out in hardcover is what I bought at the Festival of Books and got it signed. So I liked it. And I'm not going to go too much in the story of it, but it was much better. And the last 100 pages, it's only like 280 pages. The last 100 pages really moved fast, which is where I like a book that when it gets down to the end, I want it to move fast because I want to feel like it's coming at a breakneck pace where I need to read it. And then the last book I read is the Jerry Royce book, Bring in the Right Hander. Obviously, we knew and know of Jerry from baseball camp, and you saw him last week and bought the book. And I don't want to talk too much about it because, I mean, it's a story over 22 years in baseball. But I find, as I was reading this book and as I experienced other media, that I have a jealousy streak.
I am jealous of people who get to do some of the things that I only get to dream about. And to hear Jerry's story where he played for 22 years, it's like, I'm just jealous. I'm jealous that he got to have those experiences. I'm jealous when I watch, you know, freaking the Battle of the Network Stars, and you get these people who are famous and they get to do these obstacle courses. Sometimes it gets to the point where it's difficult to read or watch those things because I'm just jealous that they got the opportunity to do them and I didn't. And for Jerry's book, I had a mixture of that jealousy, but also a little bit of a feeling of being in the in crowd because we've gone to baseball camp. We got to hear some of the stories are repeated. And having had the experience with him of sitting down and talking to him and hearing some of these stories, I'm reading the book, but it's his voice talking in my ear. And it was just really fun. And it's a 250-page book, and I think at least a third of it is spent on his time with the Dodgers, which when I started reading the book, my concern was, I don't want to hear too much about the Pirates and all the other teams he was with. I want to hear about the Dodgers. Vast majority of it is with the Dodgers. Good. And so I liked it.
Good.
So that was, and I finished it last night.
That's
very cool. I definitely look forward to reading it as well because he's, you know, he was one of the guys that I was excited to meet when we went to our first camp because he's a power lefty pitcher. And, you know, the coaches that were at camp, he was the one, you know, because I'm a left-handed pitcher. And, you know, to end up on his team and then to end up on his team again, I mean, to have a relationship with him, like you said, I saw him last week, I got the book signed, he knew who I was, he told his publicist that, you know, he said, this guy threw one of the best games I ever saw, he had 15 strikeouts, and his curveball was working, and his fastball was working, and, you know, to have that kind of impact that our family has, and you and I and Dad have, is really something special. And, you know, to read his story, and, you know, you talk about, like, that jealousy factor, it takes a lot of work for us to play once a week. Think about playing every day, and we don't have the pressures of, if I fail, am I going to be sent down, or am I going to be cut, or am I going to be traded? And, you know, there is that level. I mean, I'm not poo-pooing it at all, because it was my dream as a kid to be a Major League Baseball player, and it's my dream for my son as well. Luckily, Tether's as well. but you know, you mentioned the Battle of the Network Stars thing, and I immediately think, well, we did the Foam Fest last year, and those events were way cooler than, and we did the Spartan Race, and I mean, we challenge ourselves, and we try and do these things, and they may not be as fun, or they may not have the prestige, but, you know, we get to do those things as well. So, I mean, we have our lives, and, you know, I don't know if he talks about it, I don't think he does talk about his family. Yeah, and he mentioned at camp, he says he doesn't talk about his wife, he doesn't talk about his family, because that's private. And, you know, you have to take it a step back and go, well, you know, if you were a Major League Baseball player, you'd be on the road half the year. When do you get to see your kids? When do you get to see your wife? Yeah. I mean, you don't get that opportunity. And it wasn't until I saw him last weekend and he signed the book that I actually knew he was married. He had a wife.
Was she there?
No, she wasn't there, but he mentioned her. I don't know if he has kids. See, Rob says he has kids because he mentioned it. I mean, but you don't get that. And we have good relationships with guys like Gary Ingram and Mari Reed. They're not married. They don't have kids. They don't, you know, they don't have those kinds of relationships. I mean, of the people that we know, of the people that we're friendly with, of the people that we respect, Jeff and Dale Torborg are the only ones that come to mind of people that have made a life in baseball, have family, have close family, still have close family, still work in baseball. Dale still works in baseball, and, you know, but it takes a long time to get there. So, you know, to read this book, I'm really excited. I mean, we've obviously read many autobiographies about Major League Baseball players, whether it's Gary Carter or Steve Garvey or Rod Guidry, you know, I mean, Jackie Robinson and Duke and Gil Hodges and Sandy, you know, Kovacs. I mean, you got all of them. we are also very fortunate. As lucky as they were, we are lucky as well.
Yeah, and I don't want to go too much into that, but it was something that occurred to me not too long ago, which is that we've been really lucky. We've got to have a lot of experiences just by virtue of the fact that we have a love for this game. And when you look at, if you go to
just go to a Dodger game and you see the 50,000 fans there and you say, you know, 99% of the people in the stadium will never set foot on that field. And set foot on the field meaning stand on the mound or stand at the plate or look around, you know. And we've had that opportunity, or have that opportunity to rub elbows with a Jerry Royce or a Steve Yeager or a Rick Monday, or to have these people know you by name, or even just to have the opportunity to go play where they're watching you. Mm-hmm. No, I agree. It's an opportunity that we had that I'm not ever going to downplay or take for granted, because it's something that thousands and thousands, if not millions, of kids grow up wanting to do. And yeah, we never got to that level, but we got to the level where Jerry Royce is saying, this guy threw, you know, at 30, however old we were at the time, 36, 35, 36, you know, threw one of the best games I've ever seen. I mean, this is a guy who pitched for 22 years. I mean, he knows good pitching when he sees it. Needless to say, you did not make it into his book. Sorry. And he only made one mention about the Dodger fantasy camp. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
And we weren't in it.
Oh. But I don't in any way downplay or take for granted the opportunities that we've had to have those experiences. So, you know, God willing, we're going to have more of them. So, anyways, so last thing. I mentioned earlier I'm starting the Steve Barry book, this Templar Legacy. The reason why I think I told you is because of this Thriller Fest that's coming in July. And Amy won this contest because she is a big fan of Steve Barry. And she basically won a contest to sit at his table at a banquet honoring this book coming out called Face Off, which is, as we talked, you know about, yeah, an anthology of short stories, I guess, involving the stories were written by multiple authors, where they brought their two main characters and they put them in the same story together. So, I mean, you've got Steve Martini and Michael Connelly and Dennis Lehane and Steve Barry and all these other great authors. So Amy won this contest to sit at his table, and that means that we both get to. So I'm going to start reading his books to be familiar with them,
so that when we go into,
yeah. Can you imagine? Hey, Mr. Barry, nice to see you. Excuse me for a second. I need to go over that table where Scott Turow's sitting. But I'm going to do that. Michael Connelly is sitting.
You say, excuse me, Mr. Barry. What do you think of Scott Turow's new book?
Yeah. But so I'm starting to read his book, so I have something to talk about.
Hey, I'm a big Michael Connelly fan. Would I like your books?
So that's what I started. But I want to hear about your book. I've been dying to talk to somebody who read this book, because somebody recommended it to me a while ago. And it's a friend of mine. She's another attorney, but she is out there. And would you believe she belongs to a book group that focuses only on like science fiction and end of the world type books? This is the book group. And this is actually the one who recommended that I read The Handmaid's Tale, which I really liked. But she's recommended this book to me before, and I've picked it up and I've looked at it and I flipped through it and I put it back, and I got to hear from the horse's mouth, tell me about World War Z. The first thing that I will say is you should buy it and you should read it. It's definitely one of the best books I've ever read. It says a lot. It does say a lot. It's really, really remarkable. I didn't know what to expect. I mean, obviously, it's been around for a while. I saw the movie trailers. I was curious about and interested and wanted to see the movie. I know many people who are, you know, devoted and to it. I know a couple of people, in fact, at work that have the book on their desk. I mean, it's very important. I didn't know what to expect. And I was just blown away at how good it was. I read one review of it, which I think put it best, which was, if this book were to be made into a movie, it would be a documentary. And I, you know, similar to the Seth MacFarlane book, I had the ability to watch the trailer over and over again as I was reading the book, and to realize more and more that the movie and the book
have nothing to do with each other at all, at all. It seems like the movie just took the title, and that was the end of it. Because the storytelling and the writing is so good. It's entirely, all you're doing is reading interviews. And it makes it that much easier to read. One of the issues that I have with reading nonfiction books is there's no dialogue. And it, you mean, I feel that I need the dialogue to break up the monotony of the book. This book is all dialogue. All you're doing is reading transcripts of interviews. This one guy has gone all over the world, all around the world, and met with different people and heard their stories of the war. And it is called World War Z because it all focuses in on the impending war with the zombies, but the war doesn't take place until the last quarter of the book. Everything building up to it is people's memories of, this is where I was, this is where how I got out, this was my first involvement, this is how I survived, all of that. And then in the last quarter of the book, you actually get to the war and how it was, how the zombies were defeated. And then ultimately you do come back to a couple of the characters and find out where they are from there.
And I was going to ask you, there are actually characters in the book. Do you follow their story from beginning to end?
Not really. And that was one of the things that I had issue with, was you have, it's all testimonials. That's all it is. So you have so many testimonials, and it all builds through the first three quarters of the book. And then you get to the war, and it starts to go back to a couple of those testimonials to backtrack itself. So ultimately what you're seeing is the interviewer took, you know, did these interviews with these people, person A, person B, person C, person D, all the way up to the war, and then it's almost like he cut off the interview of person A at this point and then brings it back at the end during the war to like come back to it. So it's really fascinating because, yes, you're dealing with a zombie apocalypse, but the political ramifications of it and the survival instincts of the national governments is what's really the most interesting. How the Indian population dealt with it, how the Russian population dealt with it, how the American government dealt with these issues. I don't think I'm going to ruin anything when I tell you, and I don't think it's a spoiler alert, but the one nation in the world that was the best off, that survived with the least amount of casualties, was Cuba. And it makes total sense. Because of the embargo, they didn't have any import. So how is anybody that was affected or was infected come in? So ultimately what you find out at the end is the most powerful country in the world is Cuba. So it puts that intelligent spin on it. You're not reading The Walking Dead. You're not reading about a handful of people that are fighting the zombies. Or The Stand, because that's what I thought about when I was reading it. You're not. You're reading about different people all around the globe and their testimonial of where they were when the outbreak happened, where they were when the outbreak came to them, how they survived, what they did to survive, what they did during the war, and then ultimately at the end, how the war was eventually fought and won. It's very fascinating. It really is a very well written book, and it's very fascinating. Like I said, one of the other commentaries I read about it was that it was a satire, and I don't see that at all. I see it more as a cautionary tale, not a cautionary tale about a zombie outbreak, but about international government's response to a situation that they're not prepared for.
And they talk a lot about a particular person, and I can't remember his name, and his doctrine or his thesis about how to survive this zombie apocalypse. And one of the things that he suggests is you basically take all of the best of these people, take them someplace else and quarantine them, and let everybody else just fight it out for themselves. And it's sickening to think that a government would adopt that kind of philosophy, to say the only way that the human race is going to survive is to take the cream of the crop of these people, put them someplace like Antarctica or Greenland or Cuba, you know, something like that, and then let everybody else try and figure it out for themselves. So it's frightening in that regard, but it makes sense. So, you know, we were talking about the Trident deception and the plausibility of it. Obviously, the plausibility of a zombie outbreak, everybody knows that's totally legit. but it's the international government's response that's so fascinating.
Yeah, I get that.
Okay. Do you want to read it? Are you interested in reading it? I mentioned that one of the issues I have with reading nonfiction books is the lack of dialogue, because it helps to break up the monotony. This, like I said, all you're reading is testimonial, so it really is like reading a court reporter's statements. I mean, actually what you're doing is reading up typed up notes of this guy's audio tapes of these interviews. So it does tend to at times get a little slow, but the really juicy, deep testimonials are the ones that you really get a lot of power out of. And I think that, you know, to suggest going into this book that I would have an emotional response to a book about zombies, I would have said, you're fucking crazy. But I really did. It's really, really fascinating.
It's interesting, because I have picked it up and flipped through it many, many times. And it seems like it's like an encyclopedia. And I can't figure out, just by flipping through the book, if there is an actual story arc. And so what you're saying is there is a story arc, but it's not a traditional story arc, meaning you follow a linear path from beginning to end. Some of it is, or I imagine all of it is, told from a flashback point of view. This is where I was when this happened, and then this happened. So I do want to read it. I am interested in reading it. I want to see the movie. I understood, or at least when I knew the movie was coming out, it was my understanding that the movie was not a lot like the book, but that the movie may be the precursor to a sequel, which then brings the book's more of the substance of the book into play. So I don't know if that's the case.
Well, this is Max Brooks' second zombie book. He wrote one before this, which is something like Handbook to Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse or something. Okay. And I've got to imagine it was. And I have to imagine that that's probably where more of World War Z, the movie, came from.
Oh.
But the you talked about the linear path of the book. It starts with the infection, but it's fortunately for Max Brooks the writer and the interviewer, the writer of the book, fortunately the doctor that initially encountered the outbreak is still alive, so he's telling us.
Oh, okay.
I went to this village in Japan, and so-and-so had this thing and this rash, and there were four of them, and they all had the same rash. And an old woman said, there's a, you know, this kid, he went diving and blah, 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 and he's in a cage and he's rabid. And, you know, so you find out how the outbreak started. But then it goes to a teenage girl, and her parents see on TV that there's some outbreaks, so they start, you know, trudging up north or in America. They're trudging as far north as they can go because the zombies can't get through the snow, and, you know, because they freeze in, you know, because it's taking into consideration our understanding of what zombies are, which is, you know, Night of the Living Dead. They move slowly. They can't open doors. I mean, even you know, things like people, you know, somebody telling a story about walking, you know, through the country and encountering cars with zombies in their car because they can't open the door to get out, you know, I mean, things like that. So, you know, and it even goes, the thing that I found so fascinating was I really felt that the author thought of everything, and he looked at it from every perspective, from every level of sociology, from every different perspective internationally. He even looked at it from a military standpoint. He has a whole section of an astronaut that was on the space station at the time this was going on. So he really has thought of everything, and you're seeing it from every different perspective. And then ultimately, like I said, when you get to the actual war, how are they defeated, which there was no way to actually defeat all of them, but I mean, to get to a point where they overtook, it's really fascinating, and it points out a lot of interesting things that we do with our military, and obviously, like I said, about international government response to the unknown and situations that they weren't prepared for.
Wow. So this is like a 1,000-page book. And it seems like it has to be.
I think it was only like 300 pages or 300 some pages.
How do you do all that in 300 pages?
You actually do it really well. I mean, because if you think about it, everybody's testimonials maybe 6 to 10 pages. You're talking about 30, 35 characters. It's quite a bit, and it goes all over the world.
All right. So, yes, this is one that I want to read. Like I said, I picked it up many times, put it back down, but based on your recommendation, I'm going to read it. So, what's next for you?
So, I started reading The Road by Cormac McCarthy. I'm intrigued because I know that he has made, or that he has had books turned into movies, as well as he wrote a screenplay for a movie that came out not too long ago, The Counselor. That Ridley Scott directed, that looked really good but got terrible reviews. But he also wrote No Country for Old Men, and I was very curious to read one of his books. I got a friend at work who is a fan, and I knew. I had read online that James Franco was looking to adapt one of Cormac McCarthy's novels called Blood Meridian, which I read about online. It looked really interesting, so I asked my friend. I said, do you read Cormac McCarthy? He said, yes. And I said, I'm interested. What should I read? And he said, The Road is his best. He said it's bleak, but he also said it's really good. It's really powerful. And it's the story of a father and a son. And I have a son. And he said, as the father of a son, you know, he thought that I would really like it. So I'm about 40, 50 pages. It's been a slow week. It's, you know, bleak. Hmm. It's pretty bleak. But, you know, I'm curious to see where it goes from here. And, like, I have no idea where it goes. So I'm excited to see where it goes from here.
It's not that long. It's like 200 pages, something like that?
Long. Yeah, maybe 250, 270, something like that. Yeah, they're not that long.
Okay. And do you have any idea of after that?
No, but I got to come up with something.
I don't know. Well, you're going on your trip.
I know. Well, I'm going on a trip, so I need to find something else to read from here. It sure is surely going to be Rick Campbell's second book. That's all I got to say.
All right. Well, when you figure it out, you'll let me know. I've got an idea of what I want to read coming up.
All right.
But it's actually a 3-book set.
All right.
And it requires a commitment. I'd have to actually read them in a row. All
right.
So, last year, I read Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson, and I really liked it. And it's like a novella. It's like 100 pages. And I think I read it over the course of a day or two. And I saw in the bookstore last month a new book that came out, and it's called Hyde. And it's the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde story told from the standpoint of Mr. Hyde.
Right.
And in fact, I think it starts when Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde ends, and then it moves forward, and there may be flashbacks, I don't know. And then on top of that, there's a third book called Mary Riley by Valerie Martin, and it was a movie.
I thought you read that already.
I have not read it. It was a movie with Julia Roberts and John Malkovich, and it's the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde story told from the standpoint of Dr. Jekyll's maid.
Right.
And so I found that used online, and I bought that as well. So I want to read those books, but that would require me to reread Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, which I'm okay with because it's only 100 pages, even though I have this standing mantra, I don't reread books. But I want to read all three of them in a row so that I can kind of piece it together and figure out where they work. And I haven't figured out how I'm going to be able to do that yet. So that's on the horizon, but that's something I'm really interested in because I'm kind of looking forward to undertaking that. But that's where I'm at for right now. You got anything else?
No, just read World War Z before that.
Okay, but at this point it's your turn. You got to pick another book.
Oh.
So you don't got to pick it now. You'll figure it out and you'll let me know.
Start reading The Road.
I'm not going to read The Road. I'll let you tell me how it is, and then I'll decide. But from what I've heard about it and what I heard about the movie, I ain't interested.
Really?
All right. Well, we'll see.
I don't know.
I'll let you figure it out. You got anything else?
No.
Okay. That's it.
So that's it for Phil and I. This is Book Therapy. You can find me on Twitter at BookTherapy13. BookTherapy13@gmail.com. Rate us if you listen. Put us on iTunes. Let us know what you think of it. Really curious to see if any of y'all are listening. And other than that, thank you for letting us lie on your couch.